Good afternoon and welcome to Central Coast Voices. I'm your host, Chris Kington Barker. That's the first time I've heard that whole song played. In 2006 general election, less than 64% of registered voters came out to vote. With more than 180,000 eligible voters in San Luis Obispo County, why don't more people participate? With the November election only a few weeks away, what is the best way to be informed about the important ballot measures and learn about candidates? But more than that, who's voting? How do they vote? How do we register to vote? What happens when we register and what happens when we vote? My guests today will be sharing their knowledge and expertise on these topics and why it matters for all of us, regardless of what city or county we call home. My guests today are Mary Leigh Hyman. Sorry. And she's the president of San Luis Obispo League of Women Voters for the County of San Luis Obispo. And Judy Rodenwald, and you are with the county, you are currently the county clerk recorder, and you have been reminding me that you're soon to retire. And you've been doing this a long time.
About 20 years.
That's going to be, wow. And Michael Lattner, who's professor of political science and public policy at Cal Poly University, San Luis Obispo. A reminder that today's show is live and you can be part of our discussion by calling in with your questions and comments. To make sure your comments get on the air, please call us earlier in the show. The number, if you want to write that down or remember that to call, is 781-3875. And I appreciate all three of you being here today.
Pleasure, Chris.
Thanks for having us.
You know, I think probably a good place to start, Julie, is really to talk about some of the basics of just the voting process, if you don't mind.
Sure. Yeah, it basically starts, as you said, with registering to vote. Yeah. And to be eligible to register, a person needs to be at least 18 years of age on or before the election day. So 17-year-olds can register now if they're going to be 18 by November 4th. And they need to be a U.S. citizen, and they need to be not in prison or on parole for a felony conviction. Other than that, it's open to all of our citizens. Right now, we have about 148,000 registered voters in our county, which should increase before the election. But sometimes it's as simple as filling out a paper form, which is kind of the old-fashioned way of registering to vote. But several years ago, the Secretary of State created online voter registration where a person can actually complete their voter registration card online and submit it. And if they have a California driver's license, it ties their driver's license signature to their voter registration, and they can complete the process in one step. That came in right before the 2012 general election, and we had people that were registering at like 11:59 and 50 seconds prior to the deadline.
So you can register that close in?
Absolutely. As long as we get it by midnight on the registration deadline, they will be eligible to vote in the upcoming election, and that's 15 days before the election. So for this election, it would be October 20th.
Now, that would be for people that want to go to a poll site.
Not
or
necessarily.
Is that also for mail-in votes?
For mail-in votes, they can request to be a permanent vote-by-mail voter and on that same form, and we will automatically mail them a ballot for every election, for every future election.
So for if they were to register that close to the election the first time, would they be able to register? I mean, would they be able to vote by mail that first time?
Yes, because we can mail ballots up until 7 days before the election. So if we got that registration on a Monday, we'd process it on Tuesday. We'd have a ballot out in the mail on Wednesday, and they would just have to mail it back so that we received it on election day, or they can turn it in at any polling place in the county. If they're out of the county, that makes it a little bit more tricky. They're away at school. They would, you know, just an additional mail time for them. But typically, that's plenty of time to get ballots to people and get them back.
Now, for individuals that are not, if someone is a student living here, they become a resident. here during the time they're a student here?
Students have the opportunity to either to choose either to register here at their address, mm-hmm. Either on campus or if they're living somewhere off campus, or they can register at their parents' home and then just have their mail sent to their address here. But it's all California voters have that option of what their residence is and what their domicile is. And okay. So that's the choice that they
make. Do they need to choose between one or the other?
Yes, they can only be registered in one county. If we get a registration and they indicate that they were registered in San Diego County, we would send San Diego notice to cancel their registration so that they're not registered in both counties.
Okay. Now, there's kind of a belief in some people that if they registered to vote, somehow that ties them to jury duty.
Right.
Being on that little call list that comes out.
Right. So jury duty notices, they actually use two databases. DMV, so if you have a driver's license or a California ID card, you're in the database. They also use the voter registration database and kind of bump them up against each other so they don't have duplicates. So
right.
If you don't want to be on a jury, then you can't drive a car, you can't have your car registered, you can't have a California ID or be a registered voter. Those are the opportunities. We always encourage people, if that's the only reason that you're not registering to vote, then register before an election and then cancel your registration right after the election so that at least you can participate in the election. And then you're not on the books until the next time you come up and register to vote.
And you can do that.
Yeah.
And how would you cancel?
You just write us a note saying, please cancel my registration.
That's very tricky. I'll have to remember that.
Yeah, it's, I know. It's a little subterfuge there. But, hey, if it gets people to register to vote,
to
that's
vote.
All. That's
yeah.
what I'm all about.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And then if they don't vote, is their registration canceled? If I register and then decide either, well, I buried my ballot and forgot to send it in,
right.
then – what happens?
No. The process in California is a little bit involved, but in order to – so the first process is that you would be inactive, and that only happens if we receive something that we mail out to you comes back to us from the post office saying they're no longer
like
there.
Like I moved and didn't forward.
Right.
Okay.
So we get a notice. We inactivate you. You have to be inactive through four federal general elections before we can cancel you. So you have an opportunity to vote in eight elections. And if you're inactive and you come back and vote and you're still living here, then we would reactivate you. So it's 8 years on that inactive list before we can ever cancel you. So it's you have a lot of opportunity to show back up and cast a ballot.
Okay. Now, how are you notified if somebody is deceased?
Several ways. We get the death certificates from inside our county. And then we also get what we call a death list from the Secretary of State that gives us deaths throughout the state that are potential matches, and also from outside the state that are potential matches with voters.
So that's
in ours.
Taken care of internally.
Right. And sometimes we get notification from the family members because we mail a ballot to them or we mail a sample ballot, and then they notify us that the person's deceased.
So if somebody is registered along a party affiliation, is their material different than another party?
Well, in California, it's changed like five times since I've been county clerk.
Yeah.
The current system is that in the primary, we have what's called a top two primary, which means it's open to everybody regardless of their party affiliation and regardless of the candidate's party affiliation.
Mm-hmm.
So in this primary election this year, everybody got the same material,
okay.
no matter what party they're registered with. In the presidential election, that does not extend to the presidential contest or what's called the Central Committee, which are the party governing bodies. So in that case, typically you can only vote for the president for the party with which you're registered, except parties can allow declined estate voters to cross over into their primary and vote in their primary. So it kind of depends for the presidential elections. Typically, it's along party lines. Republicans vote for Republicans, Democrats vote for Democrats. But declined estate voters can be allowed to vote in a party primary if the party says that they can.
Now, what if somebody wants to switch parties? How do they do that?
They do need to complete a new registration card, either online or do a paper. But we do need to have their new signature on file to switch party affiliation so that they know it's the voter that's requesting
that. Can you do an electronic signature, or does it have to be?
It has to be tied to the DMV signature.
Okay.
So
they need to have a wet signature.
Right, unless they register online and it ties it to their DMV signature.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. And then do people understand that? Do you find...
No. It's always a challenge for us. You know, I mean... My office staff and I, we live and breathe it. And we think, well, of course everybody knows what the rules are.
Right.
But like I say, they've changed 5 times since I've been county clerk. And they only come up, a presidential election only comes up every 4 years. So you've got new voters. People don't remember what it was like the last time. So it is a public education challenge for us to get the information out so that people understand if they want to be registered with a party and what their voting options are if they are registered with a party.
Especially if you're thinking that you're registered with a party, you don't need to change that and you still have the same open options.
Right. And you may not be registered with that party because it didn't make a difference in the last election.
Correct.
Because it's the open primary.
Correct.
Right.
Yeah. And then how, you know, how long do you take in this county after the election to complete counting the ballots, like the mail-in ballots?
Right. So
and do you always count them?
Yes. there's a common misconception. Well, if there are no close races, you don't count the ballots.
Really?
Yeah, really, we do count. We count all the ballots. I can guarantee you that. My staff can say we count all the ballots. By law, we have 28 days. We typically we try and finish the counting because that's the part that people – that's what they want to know, particularly if there are close races. City council, often school districts are very close races. We try and get all those ballots counted by not the Friday of the week of the election but the Friday of the week after the week of the election. And then we probably have another week to week and a half worth of work to do where we verify everything and go back and double check before we can say, yeah, these are the accurate results of the election.
Are you seeing more people mail in ballots?
Oh, yes. We're up to, you know, in the primary, it was probably 60% of our voters voted with a mail-in ballot. Many of those drop them off at the polling place, and that's what we're finding is that on election day, we might have 15,000 to 25,000 ballots that get turned in that day that we can't even start processing until the day after the election. So that's why people are so surprised when we say, well, the results from election night, we're done counting the ballots that got turned in at the polls, but we still have 30,000 more ballots that need to get counted before we can say that the election's over. And the media, who I just love this time, because they say, so when are you going to call the election? No, 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 we don't call elections. Mm-hmm. We count all the ballots and then tell you what the results are. We don't tell you what we think that they're going to be.
Right.
It is quite a lengthy process.
I'm so curious, when you say you count the ballots, do you have people sitting in a room visually inspecting the ballots?
We do. Staff does visually inspect the vote-by-mail ballots because we want to make sure that they've marked them properly, that they, you know, sometimes people mark a bubble and then cross it off and mark another one and say, I wanted to vote for this
person.
So
what happens when they do that?
We go through a process where it's called correcting a ballot. And so if we can determine voter intent, we actually use cover-up tape. So put it on the ballot so that the machine won't read that mark that the voter didn't intend to mark. But you can still take that tape off and see what the voter intended to do.
Huh.
Sometimes they'll cut their ballots or mark in the timing marks, and those we have to actually duplicate. We get a lot of ballots with coffee stains on
You've
them.
You've gotten mine, I can tell.
Was I looking at you? I'm sorry.
I knew it.
And those have
and
to be
spaghetti sauce.
Yeah, spaghetti sauce, lots of that, which is good. People are voting. That's the important thing. Those have to be duplicated because the machines won't read those ballots. They can't determine if that's a vote or a coffee stain.
So you visually inspect to make sure that they'll go through a machine and then they're actually counted in
They're counted machine. With the machines,
And what
right.
happens if people decide they're just not going to vote on an issue?
So it comes into us blank.
Yeah.
Yeah, we get a blank ballot. We actually get, you know, during an election, we'll get anywhere from, I don't know, 5 to 20 completely blank ballots. They wanted to cast a ballot, but they didn't want to vote for anything on the ballot, but they
right.
wanted to be noted as somebody who voted. They just get – we override the machine. It'll kick it out to make sure that they didn't mark it in red, which would show up as a blank ballot.
Interesting.
So we just make sure that it really is a blank ballot, and then two of us sign off on it that, yeah, we saw that it was a blank ballot and we override it.
And is a ballot still valid if people have not voted on particular areas?
Like yes.
they vote on a couple of things, but there are a lot of things that they just didn't get or they don't care about.
Right. So you don't have to vote on anything, like I said, with
right.
the blanks, or you can vote on only one contest
okay.
and it has no effect on the rest of your ballot.
Well, this is great. This is a great conversation for
yeah.
me. Yeah. See, everything I wanted to know and was too lazy to call in. You are listening to Central Coast Voices on KCBX Radio, streaming worldwide at the web at kcbx.org. I am joined today on Central Coast Voices by Mary Lee Hyman, president of the San Luis Obispo League of Women's Voters, Julie Rodenwald, who you just were listening to, is the county clerk recorder, and Michael Lattner, professor of political science and public policy at Cal Poly University in San Luis Obispo. We have we are talking about voting and issues related to voting and why it's important for all of us to be a part of that process. You still have time to get involved. And as Julie was talking about, if you haven't registered, you can still register. Plenty of time to do that. This is a call-in show, and you can add your voice to our discussion today by calling us at 781-3875. And I'm going to turn over to you here, Mary Lee, because as the League of Women Voters, something that I think you have been so so effective at is actually making it possible for so many more people in this country to vote. Can you talk a little bit about your organization and what the League of Women Voters
I would love to talk about the League of Women Voters, but I would also like to comment. You can tell by listening to Julie. Why you can understand how we are so fortunate in California and in this county to have Julie and her elections office run our elections. They run so well. I have told her many times we should rent her out to the rest of the country. We are the model. We really have great information out there and good controls. And I can tell you, I just received your letter, Julie, on the processes where outside people are invited to come and inspect and oversee and audit all those processes she just described to us.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I can personally attest that they do check those signatures because when I ran for office, my husband didn't get to vote for me because he put his wrong signature on it. And it was a vote by mail.
He has a wrong signature?
Well, he has two signatures. Oh. He has two, you know, the name he loves and the name he was born with.
Oh,
so
okay.
He uses both. And so I can tell you, they really do check those things. About 100 years ago, women gained the right to vote in California, and women quickly realized that we need to learn what we're voting on and also to influence what we're going to vote on. And we started to shape some of the issues into social issues, just not wars and the
right.
things men care about, but more things families and women care about. So we formed in 1920 the League of Women Voters. Carrie Catt did that. And if you're watching the TV, Roosevelt, did you hear last night that Eleanor Roosevelt joined in 1920 the League of Women Voters. So I found that to be extremely interesting. We have 900 chapters throughout the United States. I joined the League to help on those election days, as many of us did. And we continued with voter services such as the forums, meet the candidates, find out about the issues, go to pro and cons, get yourself informed on all of the things that we care about.
And you, as the League of Women Voters, you also provide forums, do you not? You bring the candidates together and issues together and have those forums available.
Yes, we do. We're going to have one in San Luis Obispo City, Templeton, Paso Robles. We're lining one up for, we just had one for Pismo Beach, and we're lining it up throughout the cities. Organizations say we'd like to sponsor one. We'd like the League to moderate the forums because we're known for being unbiased, balanced in our approach. We don't have skin in the game for, we don't ever endorse a candidate. We will study the issues, but we'll let you know what we've studied and what our stand is if you ask. But if you want to know pros and cons, we're happy to provide those that information to you. So, yes, we're greatly involved in getting people informed.
And is that so with all of the leagues?
All of the leagues are involved in that. That's some of them of the are mission. Even more so because it's distressing across the nation. You would think, oh, we have the right to vote. Great. Sometimes we go, sometimes we don't. But we're still fighting for that right to vote. If you watch all of the states, many of them are disenfranchising people.
What do you mean by that?
You don't get to vote. Yeah. There's some reason you didn't bring an ID. We changed the rules last week. Now you have to show a picture ID. Oh, the fact that you don't drive doesn't count. It's difficult to get someone. Texas just went through that. Florida just went through that. They threw out 186,000, a huge number of voters. You know.
And can the states make their own rules about I've got head nods all the way around. So, no, really,
this
the
is not a national.
Can decide, I'm sorry, everybody in line who wore purple today, you're not going to be able to vote.
They're not quite that open to decide. There are a number of federal laws that regulate the right to vote.
And but how is it that some can say you need to have an ID with you, a driver's license, and some can't?
Right. Well, so the question of who can count as a voter really goes back to the Constitution. And this was essentially one of those issues, one of the many issues that the framers essentially punted on. Because after all, if they couldn't agree on what counts for a human being, how can they possibly decide and answer who counts as a voter? And so we don't really have a national electoral system in that sense. We have 50 electoral systems that are ran at the state level and frankly, administered to a large extent at the county level and at the local level. And the question of who has the right to vote, there are federal perimeters that are set up. But, for example, the recent spread of voter ID laws, a number of states, 21, 22 states, have now implemented some form of a photo ID requirement or other identification requirement, North Carolina being among the most extreme. But Michigan, Indiana, a large number of states have passed more demanding laws. That is, laws that require potential voters to basically prove who they are. Right?
When they show up at the polls.
Indeed. And so it's not a violation of federal laws in terms of discriminating against individuals that are at least of 18 years of age, by race, or any of the other federal protections that we have under the Voting Rights Act of 1965 and the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Nonetheless, these ID laws do not affect all voters equally.
Right.
And there's been a lot of good empirical research already done on this that shows who's disproportionately affected. And as you might imagine, the individuals that are disproportionately by affected of these laws are people that are less likely to have ID.
Right.
And those tend to be older people, people who might not drive, people who might not even have birth certificates, as well as poor people.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you fall into one of those categories, you're less likely to be able to meet the requirements. And there's been good research that shows that in some elections, this has already made a difference.
In terms of the outcome of the election.
Right.
In some states, there are so many issues revolving around voting. Why should I vote? I don't have time.
Why should I vote?
Why should you vote?
Yeah.
Well, if you look at just the propositions, there are 11 or 12 right now.
Actually, on this statewide, there are six propositions, but
statewide,
a lot of local. A lot of local.
Look at what those things are. They're about your schools. They're about your roads. They're about how you're going to be governing your own city. They are things that directly affect who you are, where you live, and your kids, and your future.
But does my vote really count? Does it make a difference?
It depends on where you live and what you're voting in, right?
Well, explain that.
I mean, the short answer is yes, of course. Your vote always counts. But practically speaking, the impact of your vote, the consequence of your vote, varies tremendously depending on where you live, on what type of voting district you live in, and the contest, right? So just to follow up on the logic of the voter ID laws that ties back into this issue of how much your vote counts, the impetus behind a lot of these laws has been the argument has been to secure the right to vote. That is, the concern among those proposing these sorts of laws is that there's the threat of voter fraud. And we want to make sure that people are who they say they are so that we know that citizens in particular, as opposed to non-citizens and other people that are ineligible to vote, are casting votes. And the research on this suggests that while it is something that a lot of voters are concerned about, the actual level of voter fraud in the United States is fairly minimal. And in fact, most of the people that actually go to jail for voter fraud are not voters, but are people like Julie. And I don't mean Julie.
Not like me.
not just like Julie, but people who are responsible for administering elections.
Right.
Because, frankly, if you're going to rig an election, it's much more difficult to try to get fake people to vote
right.
than to simply exclude people from the voter rolls.
Yeah.
Most election rigging and violations of election law happen at the administrative level.
Yeah.
And so, you know, where you live very much matters. It matters in terms of the access that you have, the registration barriers that are present or absent. And even in a more practical sense, it matters in terms of how competitive the elections are where you happen to live.
Yeah.
And so something that Julie and Mary Lee can all both speak to is the competition or lack of competition in states like California, where you have fairly high concentrations of partisanship. And so even though we have a new electoral system, we have new districts after the 2010 census, we have and they're actually much more competitive districts than we had in the previous cycle, and we have this new primary system that Julie's already spoken of, we don't have especially competitive elections. And so, for example, if you are a Republican voting in a heavily Democratic district for Congress, your vote literally does not count as much because those votes get wasted.
Yeah.
In the sense that they don't if a Republican candidate's only going to get 30-40% of the vote, that's an inefficient sort of electoral system, right? Because there can only be one winner per district. And so where you live in to a large degree determines how effective your vote actually is.
Okay. We're going to take a call here from Janine. Janine, are you there? Janine?
I'm still holding.
Okay. Hi, Janine. You had a question or comment?
Yes. My question is for the League of Women Voters.
Yes.
I'm a teacher at the California Conservation Corps, and we're interested in having someone come out to talk to our 18 to 25-year-old Corps members about why it's important to vote, how to register to vote, and what the issues are. And I'm wondering how if they would come out and do that, and how I would get a hold of somebody to find out.
Let me give you a website on how all of the information about how to contact us, because there are a number of us. You can call me directly if you want. I'm 773-6777. I will direct you to our voter services person, who is Vera Wallen, and she schedules all of our forums and all of that, and she can handle all of your questions, I hope, to your satisfaction.
That would be great, because I did send both an email and leave a voicemail, and I haven't heard back yet. So I was curious if there was a better way or how long it would take to make contact with somebody.
We do live in an answering machine. We don't have an office. So,
uh-huh.
But we have someone who does check that every day and directs it to the proper person. So
okay.
If you leave your phone number here.
You can just give yours. Or what's the website? Can they do it through the website?
Let's see, sign up. No, it gives the information she said she already used. But everybody should know where the League of Women Voters, SLO, so LWVSLO.org. And it gives you tons of information about elections, about links to both state and national information, and get you up to date.
And is that how people will get someone to come out to speak to groups like Janine?
Vera Wallen would be the one to do that arrangements.
Okay.
Or give me a call and I can get you in touch
with
Vera.
And your number again?
773-6777.
Okay. Great. Got that, Janine? Good. All right.
Thank you very much.
Talk to you later, Janine.
I'm Chris Kington Barker, and you're listening to Central Coast Voices on KCBX Public Radio, streaming worldwide at the web. If you just joined us on Central Coast Voices, our topic today is the importance of your vote in the November election and every election, and some great information about the voting process in general and what happens when you vote. My guests are Mary Lee Hyman, president of the San Luis Obispo League of Women Voters, Julie Rodenwald, county clerk recorder, and Michael Latner, professor of political science and public policy at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. And we have another call from Roger. Roger, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi. Question or comment?
Both. One, the comment was made on the show that some of these voter ID laws are designed in such a way that poor people and old people are disproportionately disenfranchised. No mention was made of black citizens and Mexican-American citizens. Many of the voter ID laws are specifically designed to exclude black citizens and Mexican-American citizens disproportionately. And there's a lot going on. And in Texas, as an example, if you're a student, that's a young person, you could not use your student ID to vote. But if you were a gun owner, you could use your gun license to vote. So a lot of stuff going on there that I think could be clarified. Now the area of question, I have a question on who can vote. Mention was made that I think prisoners or ex-cons can vote. Everybody
cannot.
Can vote in California. I'm not sure that's the case.
They cannot.
Right. So this is Julie. California, you cannot be in prison or on parole for a felony conviction. But once you're done with parole for a felony conviction, your voting rights are reinstated and you can then register to vote. But in other states, that's not true. Once you're a felon in some states, you're forever precluded from ever voting again. But in California, that's another one of those laws that the states are allowed to determine for themselves. You just can't be in prison or on parole for a felony conviction.
And Roger, we'll have Michael address your question because he was kind of nodding his head when you were talking about whether or not this disproportionately addresses minorities.
So the question of the intent of voter ID laws is very difficult to unpack. And it is certainly the case that blacks, Hispanics, other racial minorities are disproportionately affected by these laws as well. Because they also happen to be more likely to be poor. The lower income Americans are disproportionately of minorities. Now, the question of intent, though, I think it's perfectly plausible to say that these are thinly veiled attempts to reduce African American and Latino voting in some states. But they are veiled. Because you can't specifically design a law that says that African Americans can't vote because that violates the Civil Rights Voting Act of 1964. Nonetheless, it's certainly the case that in the states that have implemented these laws, the vast majority of them are states that the Republican Party took over in 2010, and this is partisan politics. As I spoke to earlier, the question of how do you rig an election, you don't get fake people to vote, you preclude people from voting. You exclude people from the voting rolls. And so to the extent that voter ID laws help one party over another, it shouldn't be surprising that we see that one party is implementing these rules and another party is suffering the consequences.
In many of the states where there is this disenfranchisement of eliminating voters for various reasons, that's why the League of Women Voters in many of the states and the U.S. are actually doing amicus briefs before Congress and the congressional hearings. And we actually sued in Florida to get the rights for people back to vote. So we're active in this, too. It's unbelievable that this is going on, but it is. And we need to be conscious to continue to fight for those rights that we paid a lot to get those rights, and we give them away too easily, and it's a shame.
Well, and that is really the fundamental question, right? Because if you take the question of eligible voters being the only citizens that are voting seriously, voter fraud is something we should all be concerned about. As citizens in a democracy, it's something that we have to protect the electoral process, and I think that that's very much a legitimate concern. The question, of course, is how much of a threat is voter fraud from the perspective of ineligible voters actually casting votes? And then secondly, to what degree are we willing to protect the legitimacy of only eligible voters voting when by necessity that means that we will implement laws that will keep some eligible voters from casting votes?
Well, shouldn't we also be equally concerned about voter exclusion?
Well, indeed. And a lot of the court arguments that have been made focus specifically on that. We can think of this as building in bias through rules, right? So the jury system, for example, we presume innocence before guilt. And that meaning that we are more willing to let a guilty person off than we are to convict an innocent person.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a plausible argument to make that we should be more willing to allow a few ineligible voters to cast votes than we should be to exclude eligible voters if the right to vote is sacred.
We don't have to go to other states to look at this as a problem. We can look at it right here at our own polls. And the training we get from the elections office is that you do everything to make sure that somebody gets to vote. We do not turn people away. You think you turned in a vote, whatever the problems are. Our system of the provisional ballot, if there's a problem, go vote provisionally, and we'll sort it out afterwards.
What does that mean, provisional?
That means we're not sure you can vote. There may be an issue, problem. Maybe you already mailed it in. We're not going to give you a second one so that you're voting twice. We'll check to see that you actually did or did not vote. So there's a system here where if there's a question about your eligibility, vote provisionally, and the office will go through and check it.
Is that something that's offered at the voting place?
Absolutely.
Here.
Absolutely. I'm an inspector at a poll,
right.
And people come, I don't know this, or I don't know what to do about, oh, we'll take care of you. Don't worry about it. And they get special treatment, a special provisional specialist, go over to their table. I call it the pink system because all the forms are in pink. But that means you're going to get special treatment to make sure mm-hmm. that your vote counts if it's eligible.
But that's unique. Is that unique to this county?
No, it's not. If I can just interject it, provisional ballots have long been in California, and then they were put into federal law with the Help America Vote Act, which was after the 2000 elections. But again, states got to decide which of those provisional ballots got counted. So in California, the process that we go through is we check, are you a registered voter in this county? Did you previously turn in a vote by mail ballot? Did you vote at any other polling place in our county? And does your signature match? And if we answer those questions satisfactorily, then we count mm-hmm. the provisional ballot. Mm-hmm. Probably, depending on the election, because a lot of the students at Cal Poly will show up and vote in San Luis County, but they're not registered here. Mm-hmm. And currently, you have to be registered in the county in which you cast your ballot. But we run between probably 85 and 95% of our provisional ballots are accepted. So it's very few.
Very high.
What was the percent?
85 to 95 are accepted. And if they're not, then they're not a registered voter, or they've already cast their vote by mail ballot. Those are the typical scenarios.
With the match of the signatures, something that just occurred to me, if somebody has a physical debility that changes their signature, do they need to do something?
Yes. Preferably.
Because it's going to make a difference, right, if it's not going to match.
Right. Preferably they re-register to vote. Okay. That's the ideal situation. We have a lot of voter registrations that are 30, 40 years old because the people,
right,
either they've moved or now with the Motor Voter Act, which came into being in 94, I think, is or 95, we now get updates. You used to have to re-register to vote. You fill out a brand new,
right,
registration card every time you move. Now we get updates from DMV or the post office or wherever. So people don't have to complete new voter registration cards. So we've got 40-year-old signatures on file.
Well, I know. Just to sign a card for the DMV, you re-register electronically,
right,
and your signature for them doesn't change.
Right. So, and that's the other challenge with the online voter registration, because
yeah,
now we're using DMV signatures that are on those pads.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you sign one of those and it looks very different from how you would typically sign. So we reach out to voters. If we get a vote-by-mail ballot in early in the process, we send them out 29 days before. We get it in the first 3 weeks. We actually send them a letter and say, we just got your ballot. It doesn't match your signature. We need a new updated signature on file for you. And for a lot of those people, we will get new signatures and then we can verify.
Okay.
And if we get it like on election day that we can't do that, we'll reach out to them after the election. But we do we try and find every possible way that we can. And what I always tell my staff is, if you were sitting in front of a judge, could you say, this is why I accepted this signature?
Mm-hmm.
And if you can find anything that you can accept it on, then accept it. But if you can't, then we're by law required,
right,
to reject it. And it makes people very angry. The gentleman sitting behind me, whose vote didn't count for his wife.
His own wife,
yes,
right. Yeah.
Is a good case in point.
You probably heard about that, too.
I don't know that I did. I've talked to other voters who went, my wife signed my ballot for me and you guys didn't accept it. Well, there's a reason that we didn't accept it.
Yeah.
But it's, that we are required to make those checks. And then we reach out to those voters after the election and say, we need a new signature on file for you. And people say, well, I have many signatures. I choose one and use it for voting.
Yeah.
Or
yeah,
if you find your signature, your writing ability deteriorating, you know it's not going to get better, get a stamp. Because
right,
you accept stamps.
Yes, we do accept.
That's
we
a
do
good
accept
point.
Signature
accept
stamps. They just have to register in front of us.
Okay.
So we will accept a signature stamp from a voter.
Okay.
We really go to great lengths to make sure your vote counts.
Yeah.
I mean, I have gone out to people's cars to bring them all of the things to sign and do their voting in their car because they can't get out.
Because they have mobility issues.
They have mobility issues.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're listening to Central Coast Voices on KCBX Public Radio, 91.1 Cayucos, 91.7 Paso Robles to Salinas, 95.1 Lompoc, 90.9 Santa Ynez, Avila Beach, and Cambria. We have about 15 minutes in today's show, and our topic is why your vote matters, and having you come to the polls or send in your card is you're not only your right, but something really important for you to follow through on. We still have a couple of phone calls that we're going to be getting to in just a moment. My guests are Mary Lee Hyman, president of the San Luis Obispo League of Women Voters, Julie Rodenwald, who's the county clerk recorder, and Michael Lattner, professor of political science and public policy at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. To reach us on air, you can still call in at 781-3875. And I'm going to take a call right now from Suzanne. Suzanne, are you there?
Yes. I'm still here. I'm here.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can.
Okay.
You had a question or comment?
Well, I had a comment because I was thinking about the Scottish voting today and how they've let – they're letting 16 and 17-year-olds vote.
Right.
So how does that look for the United States? What is that just seems to be like a very revolutionary thing, and I think it's exciting that they did that.
Well, Michael, you know, I'm glad you asked that question, Suzanne. It was one of the things I was thinking about as I was listening to the news this morning and knew you were going to be on. Kind of, what are your thoughts about 16-year-olds?
Well, there's so much to reflect on about Scottish independence. My wife and I were driving down this morning talking about just how far we move as a civilization, right? A few hundred years ago, we would have settled this on a battlefield.
Yeah, exactly.
And today we take a vote. I mean, it's a wonderful thing. Age to vote is a perennial issue in most democracies because it's one of the exclusions that we've had on the books. We change it every once in a while. It hasn't been changed since the 1970s when we moved from a 21 to 18. There's actually a strong argument to make for letting younger people vote. And while it might not be intuitive, certainly letting children vote doesn't sound like a great idea. I know that if we allowed my son to vote, we'd probably have Pokemon as president, and that would be a horrible thing.
Maybe.
But the argument in favor of letting people vote younger than 18 goes back to studying the effect of allowing 18-year-olds to vote in the first place. And so if we track voter turnout since the 1972 election, for example, what we find is that youth turnout, there was a big bump and then it declined. And young people are among the least likely to vote. And one of the reasons for that is because young people are tied into their own lives and they've got a lot going on. They're becoming adults. They're leaving their households for the first time. There's a lot that happens to 18-year-olds that actually reduces the incentive for them to vote. And so the thought here is that if we allowed 15, 16, 17-year-olds to vote, it would be part of a civic education lesson and that we could pull them into the system of democracy
earlier
and set that habit of voting earlier.
Right.
Even though most of the evidence indicates that they would actually end up voting more like their parents, right? Because they're still pretty low information voters and their parents are still respected at least somewhat at that age. And so there's actually quite a few good arguments in favor of allowing younger people to vote, because once you establish the habit of voting, it stays with you for life. Yeah. And there's actually a magic number of 3. And if you vote the first 3 elections that you're eligible to vote in, you are likely to be a voter the rest of your life.
Really?
You're going to be a lifelong voter. Conversely, if you don't vote in those first 3 elections, you are likely never to vote. Never vote.
Interesting. Did that answer your question, Suzanne?
Yeah, I think that's to think about anyway.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. Great, great question. Thanks for calling
Thank
in.
You. Okay. Bye.
And we have Lois. Are you there?
Yes, I am here.
Okay. My speaker keeps going up and down here. You had a question or a comment?
Well, I had a question.
Sure.
And it's because I've heard other people express some confusion about how does one truly register as an independent party member?
Okay.
Non-party member.
Or a non-party member.
Yeah, non-party. Lois, this is Julie. You know, it's funny. I was looking at voter registration statistics today, and the third highest party registration in our county and probably the state is the American Independent Party, which is a qualified party, but a lot of people think that they're registering as an independent voter by registering with that party. So the way to do it is to choose – I don't have a political preference. I don't have a political party preference, or I don't choose to register with a political party. That they keep changing the name. We call them decline to state voters. I think it's no party preference.
NPP,
right. So, but that's how you do it. And then you're not registered with any of the parties. Again, as we were talking earlier, it only becomes an issue in the presidential primary election because that could determine if you can cast a ballot for president in the primary.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Good question.
It's an important question because it's actually one of the long-term trends that we see that Julie can speak to in the addition of absentee voting and the increase in permanent absentee voters. In terms of party registration, both the major parties, Democrats and Republicans, are seeing declining registration, and minor parties and no party preference are the largest growing groups.
Right.
And when somebody registers as no party preference, are they getting information now for both parties, for instance, in presidential election?
No. No, that's the misnomer that people think, well, that means I can vote for whoever I want. And it's not. It means that if the party allows you to participate in their presidential election, then you can get information about that party and vote for that party's presidential candidate. But if they choose not to, and they have to do that, I don't remember the exact number of days. It's sometime in January for a June election. If they don't allow you to participate, then you can't participate. So if the Republican Party, which typically says only Republican Party registrants can participate, they don't allow declined to state voters, then there's like 30,000 of those voters in our county, and they can't choose to vote a Republican
ballot.
Even
if they wanted to vote in Republican?
They would have to re-register
as
a Republican.
That's
right. In
that's
order
really
to
important
cast a
to know. I mean,
yes.
I don't think that's commonly understood.
No, and like I say, it comes up every 4 years,
yeah.
And it changes because of the parties can allow it or not for every presidential election.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really a decision of the statewide party leadership.
Yeah.
And so in previous primary seasons, we've seen the leadership that are loyal to one candidate or over another, and so they make it as a political decision whether or not they think that there's an advantage to allowing independents and nonpartisan voter or non-political party voters to vote in the primary.
We're going to take this final phone call from Bill. Bill, are you there?
Yes.
Hi, you had a question or comment?
Yeah, I may have missed this, but I was wondering if there are any statistics kept about people over 50 who vote or people under 50 that vote.
Statistics about the age breakdown of voters?
Yeah.
Okay.
The eligible voters of each category?
Are you talking about eligible voters or those who actually cast ballots?
Eligible voters.
You know, I don't know if you have statistics, Michael, or...
Well, young people in general are less likely to register to vote, and they're also less likely to vote once they are registered. And so typically there is a life cycle effect that happens, and the older you are, the more likely you are to vote, in part because you tend to have a bigger stake in the outcome. If you've got a mortgage and you're paying taxes, you have more incentive to vote, and that actually continues up until the mid-80s and 90s, and then voter turnout starts to drop off as well. But in terms of eligibility, if you're an American citizen, and you meet the minimum requirements of being over 18, you're eligible.
And I don't know, too, if the breakdown is really, like, at 50. They're probably, you know, you could probably find breakdowns, you know, for every decade.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, I think typically we see statistics like under 30 and maybe 30 to, yeah, or under 65. So it's hard to kind of differentiate between those.
Yeah, when you're encouraging young people to vote, do you make the point that their vote is going to affect their future a lot longer than my vote is going to affect
That's a really good point, Bill.
It's an excellent point.
Really good point.
I think that, you know, it's interesting talking about that. We've had to change the whole way that we reach out to voters because of young voters. They don't read the newspaper necessarily. They don't listen to the, you know, news. So if I'm sending out press releases, so there's a whole different kind of like shift of thinking from the Registrar of Voters point of view, that how do we reach out to the voters to encourage them to vote? But I think that's a great thing to remind them of if they can get beyond next week.
And you know, and I vote every election, but you know, I'm going to be dead in 10 years if I'm lucky. And you know, they're going to have to live with my vote,
right, which
represents 10 of them.
Right. Yeah. Well, yeah, that's a good point.
Well, your question also forced us to the League of Women Voters, who tend to be older, to go into Facebook. We are emphasizing Facebook for elections. Come and like us, please.
Yeah.
And I would just add to that while young people are the least likely to vote, this is not simply a demand-side problem. This is a supply-side problem. That is, political parties and organizations that are active in recruiting voters are much more concerned with your vote than they are with young people's vote, because you are more likely to vote.
Yeah, you're more likely to show up. Thank you for calling in, Bill.
Okay.
We have about four more minutes, and Michael, I wanted to address to you. We get all of this information coming out. How can we sort through it? What do you encourage people to do who are considering voting, who are registered and want to go to the polls? How do they sort through it?
Yeah, it is tough for our parents and our grandparents. There were a handful of television stations. There were two national newspapers, and we were all getting the same information.
Yeah.
And candidates and parties had to address that information and deal with it in a way that they don't today. And so now with the proliferation of media, there are two schools of thought on that. And one is that voters are just tuning out and being very selective about their form of media, and that's true to some extent. So while there's a lot more media out there, selective perception is also playing an increasing role. So rather than try to make sense of the booming buzz of information, people are very selective. It's also the case that people use cognitive shortcuts. That is, that they look at party identification. They look at trusted news sources. They look at public leaders and people that they trust in order to make decisions. And so that's an important part of the process.
And so the key really is, talk to people, read what you can, look it up, research it,
and
don't
be skeptical.
Believe it.
Be skeptical.
Be skeptical and do your part. And I want to thank my guests today, Mary Lee Hyman, president of San Luis Obispo League of Women Voters, Julie Rodenwald, county clerk recorder, and Michael Lattner, who's the professor of political science and public policy at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, and to everyone who called in today with excellent questions and comments, thank you. Central Coast Voices is sponsored by Action for Healthy Communities and San Luis Obispo Community Foundation. Your suggestions for future show topics are always welcome. Please send them to voices@kcbx.org. Next week, please join host Fred Monroe. He'll be talking about a serious battle with illicit drug abuse among teens and how the community has joined in a fight in Atascadero. I'm Chris Kington Barker, and thank you for joining me today on Central Coast Voices.
Thank you, Chris.
Thanks for having us.
It's a pleasure.